It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, February 5th, 2023. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The president will deliver his second State of the Union address this week, and while he may highlight what he calls achievements, the road ahead may be a bit more bumpy.
I think the fundamental challenge that the president has going into this is his lack of vision for the future.
I'm Ryan Schmelz. After a disappointing 2022 midterms, Ronna McDaniel once again will lead the Republican Party through 2024. But what does the RNC chairwoman have to do to win over weary Republicans and cement her legacy with the GOP?
I think her greatest legacy is these community centers and the candidate recruitment and equipping our candidates so that they have what they need.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Last year, President Biden gave a State of the Union speech after 1 year in office, opening with support for Ukraine, which had just been attacked days earlier by Russia. He noted the pandemic and said the American Rescue Plan had worked for the American people. He highlighted the passage of the infrastructure law, but also urged the passage of the American Innovation Act, which at the time contained the CHIPS Act. He also urged for the passage of his Build Back Better agenda to, he said, lower the cost of things, perhaps not food and gas, but medicine, among others.
Nobody earning less than $400,000 a year will pay an additional penny in new taxes. Not a single penny.
He also urged for the passage of a veterans bill to address toxic burn pit exposure. All of this passed this past year, and he will no doubt highlight it all. But there's no escaping the future. And in this case, it's the debt ceiling, the looming bills we must pay on money already spent, as we grapple with $31 trillion of debt. Just over a decade ago, it was about half that. And this past week, ahead of the State of the Union, the new House Speaker, Republican Kevin McCarthy, met with the president, after which he said they're not talking about cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
I can see where we can find common ground. I think the American public would appreciate that. And I've been very clear. The current path we're on, we cannot sustain. We got to change the directory to put ourselves on a path to balance. How we get there will be our discussions.
Republicans insist some spending must be cut as effects of inflation persist. And of course, this new Republican House majority is pressuring the president and his administration in a way Democrats have not experienced in the first 2 years of his presidency. Last week, holding a COVID fraud hearing and a border-related hearing, where Alabama Congressman Barry Moore questioned the sheriff of Cochise County in Arizona, Mark Daniels.
Will you explain to me exactly who's controlling the U.S. southern border and who's getting paid?
Well, Congressman, it's a simple answer, and that is the criminal transnational organizations called cartels.
And after his State of the Union speech, the next day, in fact, House Oversight will hold a hearing called Protecting Speech from Government Interference and Social Media Bias, Part 1, Twitter's Role in Suppressing the Hunter Biden Laptop Story. And with Republicans in control of the House now, his legislative agenda may grind to a halt.
He's definitely going to talk about, even though it's skinny, the Inflation Reduction Act. He's going to talk about all the good, even though the American Rescue Act had been signed earlier, that has done for the American people and for the economy writ large. I'm sure he's going to talk about the CHIPS Act, which is a huge bipartisan win.
Jessica Tarlov is a co-host of The Five and political strategist, and will be joined later in the interview by Jason Chaffetz, a former Utah Republican congressman and former chair of the House Oversight Committee.
Infrastructure, huge bipartisan win. You know, you rarely get Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell smiling next to each other, but you did because of infrastructure. He's going to talk about this new jobs report for sure. 517,000 jobs added. It was supposed to be 187, I think. Lowest unemployment since 1969. And also the black unemployment number, I think, will be a huge emphasis in this. All that he's done for the black community that really got him elected. Talk about the money that's going to HBCUs. And I'm sure he's going to talk a little bit about things like erasing student debt. We'll see where the Supreme Court ends up on that. But that's what I envision, kind of taking a bit of a victory lap and hopefully saying the work isn't done. And we have another couple of years and inflation is still tough. And, you know, eggs cost a lot. And my daughter eats a lot of eggs. but it's going to be very optimistic. I predict the State of the Union will be strong.
And will he highlight midterms? Like, oh, we, you know, we lost the House, but we didn't lose as badly and we kept the Senate.
100%. I mean, that's the greatest midterm performance rate since the 1930s for a sitting president. And, you know, who knows what happens with George Santos? So that may be another seat that we end up picking up in the end. The fact that he took himself off of the committees, or I assume Kevin McCarthy called him and said, dude, you know, this is untenable, that something will happen with that seat. And if we run Tom Suozzi again instead of Zimmerman, then perhaps that's a Democratic pickup. And then, you know, having a two-seat margin is pretty much impossible to govern with. So, yes.
And Jason, for you, what might Republicans be thinking as he highlights all of the things Jess just alluded to or said?
Look, presidents will look back and say, hey, we did this, that, and the other. I think the Republican response with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the new governor of Arkansas, will point out, you know, the reality here, which, as the Fox News polling is showing, is that, you know, something like 56% of Democrats, and I think it's 86% of Republicans, believe that the economy is just not going in the right direction. That while people may have had gains, still the labor participation rate is dreadfully low, meaning that millions of Americans are just simply not working. They're taking federal benefits, but that isn't good for the country. And inflation still eclipses any success that these people are having. I mean, the president has given a pay raise to federal employees something in the neighborhood of 5% and is looking for an additional 8%. I think, which is a strong acknowledgement that the policies that Biden put in place are devastating to the average and lower income families, particularly people on fixed incomes, because they have not been able to gain in this economy. And for a president who is touting that he was going to work from the bottom up, for the bottom, it's not been very good. I think the fundamental challenge that the president has going into this is his lack of vision for the future. Elections, these types of speeches are always hopeful and are always forward thinking. Think of Bill Clinton was very good at this. Barack Obama was very good at this. I would argue that Donald Trump was good with this. Even George Bush would create a comfort in America that we were moving in the right direction. But Joe Biden is notoriously a poor communicator. Kamala Harris is doing him no favors. And I guess the challenge to the president going into Tuesday is, does he actually have something new, innovative, that's going to address it? I think what's going to be painfully obvious to America is he doesn't have a plan to deal with the hardships and the challenges that we're facing overseas with China, with all the scandals that the president is embroiled in, and now having to deal with inflation. He does not have a plan to address inflation.
And might some Republicans be looking for or hoping to hear about the border, or, hey, we thought COVID as a pandemic was over, but the emergency status has been extended? Or what about this $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill that we were hearing a lot about just a few weeks ago? Do you expect Sarah Huckabee Sanders to be mentioning those kinds of items in a response, or will she sort of, is the goal of Republicans in a response to sort of shift and focus on the future rather than, I guess, some past issues?
Well, I think she will point out the obvious, the things that I just talked about. But I also think, and look, a fraction of the America watches the response compared to the actual speech itself.
Yeah.
I would put this in context. The networks are really good at broadcasting it, but the number of people tuning out at that point is quite significant. But nevertheless, I think you're also going to address crime and these woke policies, the woke agenda of the left. Those two will be added, and I think front and center in what Governor Sanders, Huckabee Sanders, talks about.
And Jess, let me ask you, because while the president might highlight some of those victories that you mentioned, those as part of the legislative agenda, let's talk about some of the more recent things, right? Like the documents being found in multiple locations, an additional search of his beach home. It does not appear classified documents were found there. And the debt ceiling issue, of course, has to be resolved. He met with Speaker McCarthy this past week. Republicans have also recently held hearings on the border and COVID relief fraud. During all of this, as of late, the president was on the road highlighting the infrastructure bill, but that passed, you know, even before his last State of the Union speech. Is he sort of looking for something to pull out and highlight as something good ahead of the speech Tuesday.
Of course he is. And, you know, I put it at a 0% chance that he's going to mention that there were classified documents next to his Corvette. Right. So we can put that aside as a possibility. I think that he would be well served by talking about the border, talking about fentanyl and how many American lives we're losing to this. I mean, it's essentially an act of war, right, what China's doing in terms of pumping bad fentanyl into the country via Mexico. And the cartels have a huge amount to deal with that. We have migrant crises in a number of non-border states, right? We have it here in New York. At this moment, mm-hmm. we have 40,000, I think, that have gotten here from Arizona and Texas at this point. And, you know, they don't like their shelter accommodations. I mean, there are some truly ridiculous things going on with that. And I think it's important, especially as he's modeled himself as an olive branch kind of president, one who's mm-hmm. for all Americans and did get a lot of moderate Republican support. And I understand Donald Trump is polarizing for both sides. And, you know, if the candidate had been someone more moderate or someone who behaved in a more civilized manner, then maybe the election would have gone a different way. But talking about the border, talking about, you know, some of the crime issues in major cities that are scaring people and scaring good liberals, right? This is not just something that Republicans are walking around saying, you know, I can't go in the subway or, you know, I'm scared to wear my jewelry or what's going on in the CVS, right? In San Francisco, where if you don't steal over, I think, $1,000, then no one does anything about it. I mean, right. those are things that without getting into the specifics of it, to just say, like, the work is not done here. And looking ahead, this is the path for the last 2 years. We're going to continue to focus on the economy to make sure that hardworking Americans have good jobs, that they're taking home as much as possible. Certainly going to talk about his green agenda. It's a huge piece of the infrastructure bill and just kind of his presidency in general. He was boasting about the electric vehicles this mm-hmm. week and talking about the $7,500 credit that you get if you do buy an electric vehicle. And, you know, I think that Jason is correct about what Governor Huckabee Sanders will be focusing on. I would just caution, and I know Republicans aren't, you know, taking my advice necessarily, but if there's too much of a focus on CRT, right, or drag queen story hour, or, you know, these things that end up being fringe issues in elections, which is what we saw in the midterms. And I shout out to Shannon Bream, who I thought did excellent pushback against Governor Huckabee Sanders when she was on Fox News Sunday, saying, you know, CRT is not something that's taught in Arkansas public schools. And her first action was to sign an anti-CRT bill. Republicans will look out of touch, right? Talking about the economy and talking about people who they feel have been left behind or wage growth or some of the other things that Jason mentioned, I think will be much better for the response than just kind of going on this, you know, like they're giving our kids porn and telling them all that they're theys.
Okay. Jason.
But I do think, I think if I can add on here,
yeah,
I do think that it's going to be fascinating to see how the president deals with China. Not only do we have this mm-hmm. balloon floating over the United States of America, we have a lot of other problems and challenges. Everything from TikTok to the economy to fentanyl, as Jessica mentioned. And I think this has been a weak point, is that the president has been very reluctant to take on China and address it and create.
But Jason, is that
message.
Because we're talking about like war at this point? Is he trying to walk some line where we're calling them a pacing challenge? They're an economic competitor and trying not to push things over too far to that edge?
Well, and therein is the contrast between, I think, the Republican view of the world versus the Democrats. Democrats, if he tries to push the appeasement and, hey, let's just, you know, play nice. What has that gotten us? That's why we're mm-hmm. in the problems that we're in right now. You know, Democrats have the House, the Senate, and the presidency, congressional oversight. They did nothing to investigate the origins of COVID. I mean, that's just malpractice from my standpoint. So what are they going to do to address that? And I think it's fascinating to see what gyrations the president and his team will go through and how to, you know, not just add a sentence or two, but if it's right. an hour-long speech, is he seriously going to address China?
J- Jason, one more for you specifically about the debt ceiling talks, right? This is the big elephant in the room right now. We have until apparently June, according to Janet Yellen, $31 trillion in debt on the back end of that's in everybody's minds, right, as we talk about how we're going to pay our bills. Obviously, Speaker McCarthy is talking about making some cuts moving forward. I know you've worked with him. You know him well. He sounds like he's keeping things very close to the vest right now and not wanting to reveal too much about what he spoke about with the president this past week. But what would you hope to hear from the president about the debt ceiling at a speech like the State of the Union?
Well, I think the president, if he addresses it, will talk about the moral obligation that the reason the debt is going up is because Congress passed that, and they, now that they're spending it, they have to raise the debt ceiling, to which Republicans will respond, well, the Democrats have the House, the Senate, and the presidency. I think the other obvious contrast, and again, you don't get to have a debate up there. It's a one-way street with the president making his comments. But what is the Democratic solution to address the national debt? Do they have one? I don't think they do. I just think they want to increase the debt limit in perpetuity with no end in sight. And I think Republicans are saying, certainly the Freedom Caucus has been saying, we need a budget. You know, we need a 10-year budget. For the third year in a row, Joe Biden is going to turn in his budget more than a month late. It's supposed to be out before the State of the Union. Instead, it's coming out in March. And, you know, Republicans, again, this may get lost in the weeds with the average American voter, but hopefully Republicans will take the simple message and say, well, what is the plan? We need a plan. And actually, we not only have to balance our budget, we need to start paying down our debt, because servicing our debt, paying the interest we owe every day, is soon going to eclipse what we spend on national defense. It's that out of control.
Let's do a surprise lightning round, okay? One answer, yes or no, or a very, very brief response, all right? I just have four questions in our lightning round, okay? Here we go. Does President Biden shake any Republican hands moving down the aisle to the lectern? Jason?
Yes.
Jess?
Yeah.
Does President Biden whisper at any moment during his speech? Jess?
100%.
Jason?
110%.
Does Speaker McCarthy stand up to applaud even one time during the speech as he's sitting behind President Biden? Jason?
He should.
Jess?
Yes. I wanted to say, I know it's not short. I'll make it short. Ukraine will be a huge support for Ukraine will be a huge part of this. And McCarthy will definitely stand for that.
OK. And we know that this is a primetime speech, right? Is President Biden late to this speech as he is late to everything, Jess?
No.
Jason?
No, it's already past his bedtime, so he'll be there plenty of time.
It's past my bedtime, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
All of us.
Those of us with little children. Jess, is there one area on which both sides, this is my final question, one area on which both sides can rally, and you mentioned Ukraine, but is there a bipartisan moment or issue that you see rallying all or most Republicans in the State of the Union?
This is my hope. And there was bipartisan gun reform. And I think that there will inevitably be a moment for that about protecting kids in schools. And I hope that that will be a bipartisan moment.
And Jason, same for you. Any topic you think the president might touch that you know, Republicans and Democrats alike will support or applaud for or rally around?
I don't think it'll be the one that Jessica suggests. I do think she is right, though, that when they talk about Ukraine, when you talk about our troops, when you talk about first responders, the entire Congress, I think, will be united in supporting that.
Jessica Tarlov, Jason Chaffetz, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
After a contentious RNC election that saw the incumbent facing two challengers, Ronna McDaniel is now the longest-serving Republican National Committee chair since the Civil War. McDaniel faced pushback after critics within the party blamed her for recent midterm losses. But with three gubernatorial elections and multiple mayor's races in 2023, then a presidential election year in 2024, there's plenty of opportunity for McDaniel to cement her legacy.
Who actually thought that there could have been a red wave? I had a lot of Democratic pollsters saying it, a lot of folks who now we're saying what happened. I know Steve Bannon was out there saying it, a few others. You're going to win 100 seats. The RNC actually never said that.
Kellyanne Conway has found plenty of success on the campaign trail herself, as she became the first woman to successfully lead a presidential campaign in 2016 and served as counselor to President Trump once he took office. She tells us why McDaniel is still the right choice for the party.
They didn't buy into the red wave, as far as I can tell, because of a few things. Number one is there are so few available seats. After gerrymandering and redistricting, which has been a bipartisan effort slash failing, in my view, of both parties, there you'll never really have another 62-seat so-called shellacking, as President Obama called it, from 2010. When his party, as the party in power, lost 62 seats in the House because there just aren't enough available seats. And relatedly, in 2020, Republicans had won 14 seats. They turned them from blue to red. Democratic seats going Republican, not a single Republican incumbent lost. So they sort of banked those seats that should have been 2022 seats early in 2020. The other thing is losing the youth vote by 28% is a disaster. And it's something the party is looking into. They need to. I know there are lots of folks out there who say they've got the secret sauce on how to win young people. I like to see the secret sauce because we're not winning young people. And relatedly, the Dobbs decision did have a major impact. Overturning Roe versus Wade had a sustained major impact on a number of people, who, particularly those who call themselves pro-choice. If you look at the youth vote in places like Michigan, for example, where you can register and vote on the same day, you saw lines of up to 5-6 hours long in the freezing cold of young men and women on the campuses of Michigan State, University of Michigan, and elsewhere, standing in line to vote because Act 3 was on the ballot in Michigan. So it's funny, if you look at the Fox News polling, there were two different ways the question about abortion was asked. Both questions are legitimate, but only one really captured the zeitgeist of the sustained impact that the Dobbs decision was going to have on the vote come last November. So one way Fox News and others, including my own firm, have asked the question is, what's the most important issue to you and your family and or for you when you vote? And abortion had fallen from like number one or number two right after the Dobbs decision to number seven. But asked a different way, please tell me for each of the following issues, is it extremely or very important to your vote? And their abortion was very highly rated, almost the second most highly rated. So the intensity was there. The last thing I want to say about why the Republicans came up short compared to where maybe some thought they would be, or frankly, where they could have been if things had gone a little bit more differently, is this. We are now in a competition, not just for votes, but for ballots. And we have to adapt or die politically. I don't like all this early voting and drop box voting and COVID compelled reasons for voting that still exists 3 years after COVID. But if this is the new normal, if it's been codified and legislated and made permanent and institutionalized, then the Republican candidates and the party and the state parties particularly are going to need to adapt to that. We should not be telling people to hang on to their ballots until election day. We're taking a huge chance that grandpa can get out of the bathroom, let alone out of the house to vote. Why not bank his vote early, several weeks before? But it is completely crazy to lots of voters, myself included, that we're voting weeks and weeks before election day, and we're still counting the ballots weeks and weeks after election day. So that has to improve as well.
It's interesting. Harmeet Dhillon, I believe, made a similar comment in an interview she was doing ahead of the RNC election. And, you know, when we talk about Election Day, you know, a lot of the blame has been either pointed at Ronna McDaniel or former President Trump. Now, when it comes to McDaniel in particular, how much of that do you think is fair?
I think most of it is unfair because I know the stats that the party invested in these elections, over $300 million raised and then about 10, I think it was 17 million to the NRCC and 14 million to the NRSC. That means, in everyday language, that means also trying to support those House and Senate candidates who really needed to rely upon those congressional committees and their own fundraising and super PACs to help them get over the hump. Also, The RNC has invested so much in the ground game. And we had the RNC reports that they had 100 million voter contacts. That's a lot of voter contact that they're doing grassroots. Over 1 million volunteers. I know the chairwoman herself traveled over 500,000 miles. I think that matters. And not unlike now Speaker McCarthy, making sure that every candidate had a lot of what they asked for and what they needed. Listen, I agree with Mitch McConnell when he said candidate quality matters. No kidding. I'll tell you who I think is to blame. I think it's a lot of these consultants who walk away with bags of money, Ryan, and you don't know their names. They don't want you to know their names. They don't want the donors to know their names. They don't want the next group of victims, CEG candidates, future candidates, to know their names. They just want to sit there and blame Donald Trump, blame the RNC, blame everybody but them who made tens of millions of dollars to give whatever advice it was for people like Mehmet Oz to lose. Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania lost by 5 points to John Fetterman. To John Fetterman. That is not a squeaker. How in the world are the people in charge of that campaign not to blame? Many of whom are not working for Nikki Haley's presidential race, by the way. Some of whom are my friends, but all of whom should at least say, wow, that did not go well. And I can tell you some of them worked on the super PAC side and their firms worked on the campaign side. I think those consultants have as many houses as Oz does now. So we have to look at that too. I call it staff infection. I'm not jealous of a single one of them. I have the presidential campaign manager brass ring in my mouth. But I think if you make tens of millions of dollars for the privilege of having an R after your name as a consultant, you ought to be expected to perform and deliver, number one. And number two, and perhaps more importantly, you ought to be spending 30 to 40 hours per year of volunteer pro bono time in the bowels of some hotel somewhere in this country, training the next generation of grassroots activists. That's a must.
So I'm guessing, do you think that the RNC made the right decision keeping McDaniel in her position?
And that is a decision of the 168. Just to refresh, the people who represent the grassroots and the voters in each state as national committee man, national committee woman, and state party chair, including the territories, Ryan, that's who chooses the RNC chairman. And they went with McDonald. And I think Harmy Dillon, who I've known for a long time and who's a generously compensated lawyer at the RNC, made well into the seven figures as one of the lawyers there. And then frankly, I'm glad she's working on election integrity. She was the lawyer with Carrie Lake. You saw her in all the shots, election week. And I think Arizona, you know, frankly, in the end, it was a complete disgrace the way those ballots were still being counted weeks later. So that's something that needs to be corrected. I'm happy that everybody wants to unify and get together. I think unity is important. I think the unanimity that the Democrats have is not very Democratic, small D Democratic. Barack Obama ran around the country scolding, scaring, and shaming everybody, saying democracy is on the ballot before the November elections. Guess what, Ryan? Democracy is not on the ballot on the Democratic side. You're not allowed to think for yourselves. Why else would Hakeem Jeffries get 15 consecutive unanimous votes in a row the way Nancy Pelosi had done as the party leader 2 short years before that and 4 short years before that? 0 Democrats voted for the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. 0 Democrats voted against the Inflation Reduction Act, which did no such thing. 0 Democrats voted for Amy Coney Barrett, who was more qualified for her job than many of the senators grilling her disrespectfully are qualified for their jobs. So I'm all for unity in the Republican Party. And I know McDaniel called Mike Lindell and Harmy Dillon up to the stage after the votes were tallied, even though she had a commanding 2-1, over a 2-1 result, call them up to the stage to unify. I'm all for unity. I'm not for unanimity.
And when you mention Harmy Dillon, certainly she had qualifications, but you know, I think some might say she didn't have the name recognition that maybe somebody like Lee Zeldin would have had if he would have ran. You know, do you think that those who are opposing McDaniel maybe just missed the opportunity here to put up a candidate that had a chance?
But you got to look at it the other way too, which is McDaniel got 110 votes out of 168. And so, or more than that, or just about more than that. So she had a great deal of solid support. She locked them up early too. She said, I'm running for an unprecedented fourth term. I want to finish together what we started. And I want to, but maybe Harmy Dillon, maybe people didn't see her as a political type necessarily, meaning they know her as a lawyer and a lawyer for the RNC at that, you know, making well over 6 figures there just last year. In the last year. So they look at her as a lawyer. I met her decades ago through George Conway. And so she's been a lawyer for a very long time. And I give her credit for putting her body, soul, and name into the ring. You know, people have to get credit, Ryan, for putting themselves in the ring. And she's raised some issues that I believe will not go away easily. I didn't like some of the negative personal insults I heard going on. I'm not a big fan of that. I even tell President Trump that. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that said, less insults, more insights, please, everyone. And if you know, if we're talking about ideas and not each other, we're a winning, growing party. And I will always feel that way. I will always feel that way. And so I don't know, you know, why I go backwards about the RNC election. It's so funny. I spoke to the RNC members on Thursday night. I was their speaker at dinner. And one thing I asked them was, what is the name? And when is the last time you saw the chairman of the Democratic National Committee? Now, these are the most politically savvy, involved, engaged, wired people in the country, in their states. I mean, you can cue the Jeopardy clock. Nobody can come up with it. And there's a reason for that. That guy has all but disappeared. The name is Jamie Harrison. We were told he was going to beat Lindsey Graham in 2020. He raised $109 million. I need to repeat it. $109 million raised. He lost to Lindsey Graham by double digits. And the reward he received, the DNC chairman. And what did that get him? Well, it got him, I guess, a free pass because he refuses to go on TV with Ronna McDaniel and debate her about the two parties and their candidates. He does nothing even close to what she does in terms of flying around for the candidates, showing his face on TV, being a leader of the party, a spokesman for the party. So I like the fact that we have somebody who's out there engaging.
Right. And you said you wanted to talk about the future. So let's go into there. You know, what does McDaniel need to do early on to win over weary Republicans and ignite the party into the future? Because I think we kind of want to talk about the 2023 elections that are coming up where you have three states. You have Mississippi, which looks like it's likely safe. But you have Louisiana's Democratic governor, who's going to be term limited. Then you also have Andy Beshear in Kentucky, who's a Democrat running for re-election. So Republicans have a chance to flip two governor's mansions. You know, what does she have to do to ignite the party, and what can 2023 provide for her?
Well, thank you, first of all, for even talking about 2023, because folks have just, they zip right over to another presidential race. That would be a huge mistake for our voters and rank and file, and we can't let the mainstream media want to go right to the presidential election. Governor's race is in Kentucky, where you've got, you know, it's considered a, quote, red state, but you have a Democratic governor there, Andy Beshear, who could, you know, he could win re-election. John Bel Edwards, Democratic governor of Louisiana, two-term governor, now term limited. You've got Jeff Landry there, the attorney general, already endorsed by the Louisiana GOP, but several others have since announced they are running. So that's a competitive primary. This is important to talk about also because in Kentucky, you have a very crowded Republican primary, but there too, you've got some really great candidates. I don't need to go through them now. I don't work for any of them, full disclosure. But that's the work that needs to be done this year. And I think those building blocks in places like Kentucky and Louisiana, if we get it right there, then there's, I think we've got more to say to the electorate, to the grassroots going into 2024. And speaking of 2024, sure, there's a big presidential race, but there's obviously every House race is up again every 2 years. And then I think the Senate map is much more favorable to the Republican Party this time, Ryan, than it was in 2022. Actually, it's indisputable. The Democrats are going to have some really tough races in Virginia, certainly in Ohio, where I thought the best Democratic candidate running for U.S. Senate, Tim Ryan, lost to J.D. Vance by 8 points. Same margin of victory for Trump Pence in 2020 and 2016 in the state of Ohio, a state that Obama carried twice, that's solidly red now. Sherrod Brown's got trouble there, John Tester in Montana. So there are a number of states where the Republican Senate candidates will be competitive against Democratic incumbents or open seats. And then, of course, lots of governorships.
And does 2023 serve as an opportunity for McDaniel to unite the party if, in fact, they're able to pick up some wins there?
No question. She already has this advisory council. She announced it in November. In full disclosure, I'm on it. I'm one of the leaders for messaging for the party. It's an unpaid volunteer position. She's got Senator Katie Britt talking about moms. She's got Blake Masters, unsuccessful candidate for United States Senate in Arizona. But, you know, again, him, instead of saying, oh, I lost, forget this, it's everybody else's fault, he's talking about big tech and the party. She's got young people talking about young voters. She's got Jason Mayorkas, who's the attorney general, first Hispanic attorney general in the state of Virginia, involved. She has a great number of people who are trying to do an after action report, not autopsy like that thing in 10 years ago when, frankly, the party was flat on its backs after we were told Mitt Romney's going to win. He didn't win. This Romney's much more successful than that Romney was in Republican politics, respectfully. So I appreciate the fact that she's asking experts in a volunteer, non-paid position to, you know, to take on this assignment and find out where we did right, getting more more women to vote, more candidates of color. And I think, you know, also to have these candidates, we had a record number of women and a record number of candidates of color running as Republicans in 2020. And then we broke that record in 2022. So, and the other thing I'll tell you, because it kind of answers your question about what to do in the future for the party slash what to do, you know, what happened in 2022 and what could have gone better. You know, Ryan, we had a lot of first time candidates and I hope they run again, because first time candidates often don't succeed the first time. And many of them were terrific. They just came up short. And I hope they'll run again because they really added so much to the conversation and to the country.
What would you say Ronna McDaniel's legacy is right now? And what do you think the next 2 years can do for it?
Ronna's legacy is, well, first of all, in helping President Trump get elected in 2016. Don't forget that part. She was one of the few true believers, and she was running Michigan. And he won Michigan for the first time since 1988 as a Republican presidential candidate. I know that firsthand because I was the campaign manager towards his successful end. And she said, don't give up on Michigan. The grassroots here are for you. We're organizing them. We're investing money. If you can just come back here a few times. The very last stop that Donald Trump and Mike Pence made, election night, November 8th, actually it was November 9th by then, it was after midnight, was Grand Rapids, Michigan. It was a Monday night, I was there. There were tens of thousands of people. I'd be surprised if there were less than 10,000 people there. It was wild on a school night, the night before election night. And so first of all, she took that risk, and she took all the success that she realized in Michigan and tried to lay it out across the country for other races. 2018, the party in power always suffers grievous losses in that first midterm election. I don't hear people blaming the folks who were in charge of the political operation at the White House. I don't hear them blaming whoever was in charge of the NRCC or the NSC at the time. Again, they don't want you to know their names. They want you to forget them. Lose my number, please, Ryan, and everyone else. But what I think the big legacy is winning back the House this time, getting Trump elected in the first place, and dealing with COVID and a convention during COVID. You know, the well-laid plans to have a kick-ass convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, got blown apart because of the pandemic. Then they were moving it to Jacksonville, Florida. And then, of course, it got moved to the South Lawn of the White House because we couldn't go anywhere. It's just too dangerous for folks. They were too afraid. And there wasn't although President Trump helped bring to bear three vaccines in record time through Operation Warp Speed, they certainly weren't ready before the convention. And so I think it's that. And I think it's also helping to grow the party so that it looks more like America. I think her greatest legacy is these community centers and the candidate recruitment and equipping our candidates so that they have what they need, by and large, to run successfully. The rest is up to them and their team. But to actually have these community centers where people in communities of color, in places where Republicans don't feel comfortable, you know, these candidates like, oh, I can't go there. Nobody will vote for me. It's like, well, you got to go where you feel uncomfortable. Who cares if 8% are voting for you? Next year it could be 12%, then 16%, then 22%. Going and standing up community centers in those areas and taking a chance and believing in candidates, first-time candidates, making history with some of these candidates, the first female governor, first female governors, first female congresswoman, first Native American congresswoman, first Congress, Hispanic Congress. I mean, this is transformative at a time of great transition and some churn. So I think her greatest legacy is being the leader and the steward of a party that is growing, sometimes with growing pains, but growing and evolving along with a diverse country.
Kellyanne Conway, thank you.
Thank you so much. All the best. Take care.
That will do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Looking ahead to this week, join Fox's Jared Halpern, Jessica Rosenthal, and Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Krawshaar as President Biden addresses Congress and the nation for his State of the Union address. Until then, I'm Ryan Schmelz. Thank you for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.